From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy and social issues affecting communities of color. I'm Don Craven, Senior Vice President of Policy and the Executive Director of the Washington Bureau. And on this week's episode, we're discussing how the Trump administration is quietly changing our judicial system and what that means for you. Today, we are joined by Kristen Clark, President of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and Mr. Chris Kang, the immediate former deputy counsel to President Obama. But before we begin, a message from Mark Morial, our president and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. As long as there have been movies, there have been movie heroes. From Douglas Fairbanks' swashbuckling heroes like Zorro and Robin Hood in the 1920s, to Luke Skywalker in the 1970s, to Harry Potter in the 2000s, the movies have always produced inspiration and role models for young people and a source for fantasy and imagination. Most of these figures have been white and male. This is why the blockbuster superhero film Black Panther is such a significant milestone. Setting aside its cultural impact, Black Panther has been hailed as one of the best acted, best directed, best created superhero movies of all time. But let us not set aside its cultural impact. Representation of women and people of color in film also has been an issue as long as there have been films. In 2015 and 2016, we took the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to task for the woeful lack of diversity among Oscar nominees. Even when women and people of color do have significant roles in film, negative stereotypes are all too often reinforced. Only half of all films pass something called the Bechdel test, meaning they feature at least two women characters who speak to each other about something other than a man. Similar tests have been devised with respect to African American and other minority characters. Black Panther does not just pass these tests. It shatters the very precepts on which they rest. The significance of a powerful, intelligent, wealthy, and resourceful Black hero cannot be overstated. The women of Wakanda, Black Panther's fictional African kingdom, are the true force behind the throne and are as complex, varied, and layered as white male characters usually are given the freedom to be. When the first Black actress to win an Academy Award, Hattie McDaniel, faced criticism in the 1940s for accepting roles that reinforce negative stereotypes, she retorted, "Why should I complain about making $700 a week playing a maid? If I didn't, I'd be making $7 a week being one." Thankfully, the world of Wakanda is light years from the plantations where McDaniel's Mammy character bowed and scraped to Scarlett O'Hara. I'm thankful that our children have the opportunity to see themselves on screen as kings and queens, warriors, scientists, artists, and most importantly, the heroes of their own stories. Long live Black Panther. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
Today we're joined by Kristen Clark, President of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and Mr. Chris Kang, the immediate former Deputy Counsel to President Obama. And we're going to be discussing how the Trump administration is quietly tipping the scales of justice and the impact of their actions on the judiciary and on communities of color. Thank both of you for being here. I want to thank you both for being here. And let's jump right in. Since the beginning of the Trump administration, civil rights groups like the National Urban League and the Lawyers Committee, our legal defense organizations and advocates have had to defend against very public attempts to roll back many of the successes we had during the Obama administration. For example, in immigration, in public education, in healthcare, especially our healthcare system, the Affordable Care Act has been under constant barrage and attack by the Republicans in Congress as well as the Trump administration. However, one of the most unreported attacks that we've seen from this administration has been on the judiciary and on the legal system. And so we want to talk to you both today about that and what that means for us. Kristen, I want to start with you, and I want to start I want to start very basic, a civics lesson. I mean, you're a brilliant attorney. Take us to just the very basic civics. How does a president and judges even go together?
Sure. Thank you for having me, and thank you for shining a spotlight on this important issue. It's kind of a sleeper issue that a lot of people haven't been focused on but need to. The courts really have such an important role in our lives. When we think about the African-American experience and the African-American struggle in our country, the courts have figured prominently, from Brown versus Board of Education to all of the issues that are playing out now around voting rights and criminal justice. Some of the biggest issues and cases that are that arise are cases that are heard by our federal courts. How the courts work, you know, we've got the U.S. Supreme Court, which is at the very top, 9 members on that Supreme Court. They hear cases frequently that represent the biggest controversies in the country, but the lion's share of cases, and I'm talking about tens of thousands of cases that play out in communities across our country, are heard by lower courts. They're heard by federal district courts, which is where you start when you're filing a case in the federal system. And then some of those cases get appealed up to federal circuit courts. Where we are now is we've got a lot of vacancies in the court system, and President Trump has the prerogative to identify nominees for those vacancies. He started off his administration with the big bang. He nominated Gorsuch for a seat that sat vacant for a year on the Supreme Court, and Gorsuch was confirmed by the Senate, which is their job under the Constitution. They review nominees put forth by the Senate, and at the end of the day, vote on whether to approve those nominees. And right now, the Senate is taking up many of the nominees that President Trump has put forth for vacancies across those lower courts. And it's troubling because many of these nominees are people who have records that reflect grave hostility when it comes to race and when it comes to civil rights matters. And we've already seen the Senate sign off and approve many of those nominees. But there are many more problematic nominees that are coming down the pipeline. So that's basically how the system is set up, the role and the role of the president and the Senate, how they kind of interact when it comes to our federal courts.
No, it's a great explanation. Does it seem that the president or the administration is targeting one level or another, or is it on all levels that they seem to be focused on?
Well, I started off talking about the Supreme Court being at the top. Next comes the federal appeals courts,
right,
the federal circuit court. And so that's where they've placed a lot of energy and focused.
Because the Supreme Court doesn't hear every case. A lot of times it defers to those courts of appeal, right? So like the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, a lot of times that's where cases end.
Yeah, yeah. And the appeals court is often the last stage before a case might make its way to the
right.
Supreme Court. So the stakes are high. And so strategically, the president definitely has focused on filling those vacancies first. But there sadly are a lot of vacancies, even at the lower court level, at the district court, where cases are first heard, first filed. And so the problem exists at every stage. We're seeing nominees for the courts with real hostile records when it comes to race and civil rights, really at every stage.
Right. Chris, you worked for President Obama. We talked about that at the beginning. So you worked for a president. I mean, is this President Obama had the same prerogative as well, right? He appointed judges to courts at all levels during his administration as well.
Sure. And let me open by saying, I appreciate being here and how important this conversation is, right? This conversation is about how President Trump is quietly changing the judicial system. It's only a quiet change to those of us on the progressive side.
Right.
Right. Those on the conservative side are out there trumpeting this change. This is why so many conservatives voted for President Trump. It's why some of them still, despite everything we've seen over the last year, are managing to stand behind him, because they know that his judicial appointments serve literally, they're confirmed to lifetime appointments. They can serve for their entire life.
It's why so many people in Alabama still voted for Roy Moore.
Exactly.
Because the Republican message there was, we need a voice in the Senate to help confirm some of these conservative judges.
Right. And they focus a lot. And sometimes when progressives engage, they engage on the Supreme Court. We have to recognize, as Kristen said, these cases all start at a lower court level. They move on to the circuit court level. And only a few handful of cases are heard by the Supreme Court. So we need to understand just how big these changes are and just why these judicial vacancies are so important. So President Obama did have a number of vacancies. He sort of sought to nominate judges, and the Senate confirmed judges who were sort of fair-minded and had a progressive view of the Constitution. But we've seen a couple things that make it very different. The first thing is that in President Obama's last 2 years, Senate Republicans confirmed only 22 federal judges, which is the fewest number of confirmations in a two-year Congress in more than 50 years. Now, why did they do that? Why did they obstruct him so much? So they could leave this huge number of vacancies open now for President Trump. So when Kristen talks about the fact that President Trump still has more than 100 vacancies to fill, it's not happenstance. It's because it's part of the concerted Republican plan to let them take over these courts and to let them remake public policy through the courts that they can't do through the presidency or even a Republican Congress. And so it's that level of obstruction which has now set up this Republican pipeline, this Republican rubber stamp of President Trump's judges that makes it so different. How fast these judges are moving. Kristen talked about the circuit courts being the level just below the Supreme Court. President Trump has already had 12 judges confirmed to that level. That's the most of any president in the history of our country in their first year. That's not an accident, and it's right. Time for us to wake up and realize that this is a very loud and important change to our judicial system, and we need to figure out ways to push back.
No, it's a great point. I think the average listener is thinking, well, these are vacancies, and he's the president, but these were vacancies that occurred in many instances during President Obama's administration, but because the Senate wouldn't confirm or allow us to fill those, the country to fill those positions, they just remained vacant in the Republicans' hope they'd get a Republican president and a Republican Senate, which they have. And now they're running, they're moving forward and moving these at the speed of light. Kristen, what types of people is this president appointing or nominating for the bench?
So I want to come back to a point you just made.
Please.
You know, we've got a Republican president, but this is not a partisan issue.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing with Trump is definitely something that is very unique and unprecedented, and that is, you know, we've got a president who's putting forth the names of people who are truly unqualified for the positions that they are being put forward for. We all watched the debacle of Matthew Peterson, who was recently nominated for a seat on the D.C. Circuit Court. And he made clear his lack of experience,
right.
Lack of information about federal rules of evidence. It was
painful.
Could
answer basic questions, right?
It was
basic
painful.
Questions.
To watch and to think that we have a president who would dare put forth somebody so unqualified for a lifetime position in our federal courts is deeply troubling. And it's not just Matthew Peterson. There are a number of nominees that the president has put forth. And let me say this. Most of these nominees are white men, which is also deeply troubling. Under Barack Obama, we saw a president who was doing some work to address the underrepresentation of African Americans, of Latinos, of Asians, and women on our federal court. And he did great work to address that historical underrepresentation. About 42% of his nominees were women, about 19% were African American, 10% were Latino. And now we have a president who is putting forth a list that is about 90% white, 80% male, and it is deeply, deeply troubling. Among those nominees includes people like Thomas Farr. And if there is one name that I want listeners to remember today, it is Thomas Farr, who's been nominated for a seat in the Eastern District of North Carolina. This is a seat, a court, where you've never had an African-American before, where Obama put forth the names of two highly qualified African-American women. Their nomination sat and collected dust because of obstructionism in the Senate. They didn't move forward on their nominations or the nominations of many. And now he's put forth someone who is synonymous with voter suppression. Thomas Farr has been someone on the front lines working to defend and promote voter suppression in the state of North Carolina. among the most troubling things in his record is the fact that he defended the state's monster voter suppression law, a law that the Court of Appeals found to have discriminated against minority voters with almost surgical precision. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who has worked with Jesse Helms. He's somebody who's defended the state when they've put forth legislative plans that engaged in unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. I think that it is really important that the Senate do its job now to carefully scrutinize this nomination. He was renominated by the president last week. And the one kind of game changer here is that yesterday, the Senate leadership made a historic announcement. They put forth Senator Cory Booker and Kamala Harris to serve on the Senate Judiciary Committee that begins this work of evaluating and reviewing nominees. So I'm really hopeful that with these two strong, powerful senators at that table, that folks like Thomas Farr will be properly reviewed and vetted. There's already been some information that suggests that Farr was not honest and forthcoming with information that he presented to the Senate about his record. He offered contradictory and inaccurate accounts about his role in efforts to suppress the black vote in North Carolina. So I'm hopeful that with Booker and Harris at the table, that many of these nominees will be properly scrutinized and will vet out and root out people who are unqualified, not worthy, people who will not be fair and impartial and who don't deserve a seat on our federal courts.
You bring up a lot of great points, Kristen. Not having people of color, senators of color on that committee, it doesn't mean that Republican or Democratic members who may be white don't care, but we people of color are going to have a different perspective when we look at someone's record. And we're going to see that this was someone who was very involved in that terrible North Carolina law that was passed, that was eventually declared unconstitutional, that was trying to limit people to vote during the presidential election. A Booker and a Harris are going to look at those issues and say, wait a minute, we got to look at this guy or this gal a little closer. I'm glad the Democrats put two African-American members on the committee. I would just simply say to this, it's about time, right?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the one thing about the Urban League, we're bipartisan, we're nonpartisan, but we will call it like it is. And I'm glad the Democrats did it. And I think a lot of the reason they did it was because people were putting pressure on them, on Senator Schumer and others, to say, hey, we've got some very important civil rights issues going on right now. Why are there no African-Americans on the Judiciary Committee? So I applaud them for doing that. And I think you're right. I think they're going to do their jobs. They're both very, very competent lawyers, great lawyers. Chris, it looks like, and Kristen mentioned this, that he's appointing young. And I want you to talk to the listeners why young matters when you're appointing a lifetime judge. White, conservative, is there a strategy? You see a strategy here that they are looking for a certain type of person to nominate to these positions?
Absolutely. And I think that is. It's young, white, male, conservative. And so when we actually look at it, President Trump has nominated 69 judges so far to serve in these lifetime appointments. And that's why youth matters, right? There's a difference between nominating somebody who's 60 and somebody who's 40. It's 20 more years that they're going to rule on our federal laws and civil rights protections throughout for that district or for that part of the country. But also 69 people, only one African-American, only one Hispanic, a handful of Asian Americans out of 69. Even if you're going to find conservatives, because I don't expect that I'm going to agree with most of these people, and that's not right. President Trump has the right to nominate people who he thinks may agree with him. Senate can vote to confirm them or not. But there has to be more than one African-American conservative out there who's qualified to sit on the court.
Right.
More than one Hispanic conservative out there who's qualified to sit on the court. And I think part of the reason why these numbers are the worst numbers we've seen with respect to racial diversity going back to Ronald Reagan is because they're looking for people who are so ideologically conservative. This is not your run-of-the-mill conservative. Right. This is not, for example, we're talking about North Carolina and talking about voting. Just the other day, the court in North Carolina struck down the gerrymandered congressional districts, including a judge appointed by President George W. Bush, conservative, thought that those maps were inappropriately drawn. And on the other hand, you have President Trump putting forward Thomas Farr, right? He's looking for the most ideologically conservative, and that's the qualification he's looking for. So that's why it doesn't matter to him that Matthew Peterson's never seen the inside of a courtroom. Matthew Peterson was a conservative on the federal, was a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission. His job was to dismantle all of the campaign finance regulations, and they wanted him to be able to do that as a judge. That's why he was put on there. Right? Brett Talley, who was another failed nominee from Alabama, he's a guy who would blog about defending the quote-unquote first iteration of the KKK. Right? They put him on there because of those beliefs, not because they didn't know about them, because that's the kind of person they're looking for. That is not the kind of thing we would have seen even 10 years ago in terms of how not only ideologically conservative, but how proud they are of these views and how blatant they are. They're not hiding their light under a bushel, right? They want you to know just how extreme they are, and that is a mark to their credit when in any other administration, I think that would have been a mark of disqualification.
You know, one of the things I've learned is that the American Bar Association, which is the association that we as lawyers belong to, our gatekeeper, nonpartisan, there for the practice of law, they typically weigh in on these judicial nominations, and they'll say, we support someone being nominated. They're qualified. They're a trial-tested attorney. They've got experience. The ABA has even opposed some of these nominations, right, Kristen?
Absolutely. Okay, Chris?
Well, can I just, to clarify, the American Bar Association doesn't actually take positions on the nominees.
Okay.
And I think that they would want that to be very clear. But what they have done, going all the way back to President Eisenhower, is they've evaluated the nominees. Okay. And they've evaluated them, and then they've rated them well-qualified, qualified, or not qualified. And that's based in part on their legal experience, and that's based in large part on the reputational view that they have within the legal community. And so when President Obama, before President Obama made any nomination for a judgeship, he asked the ABA, you've been doing this for decades, you tell me, I think these are good qualified judges, but you tell me what you think with your experience, what the legal community thinks. And some of the people who we suggested, who we thought that the president should recommend or should nominate, the ABA said, actually, we have a lot of concerns. We've heard some concerns about their temperament or about their legal experience. We want you to take another look. And at the end of the day, President Obama did not nominate anybody with a not qualified rating. Mm-hmm. President Trump now has already nominated four people with a not qualified rating. And so when they say they're not qualified, it's not because they disagree with their views. It's not about policies or politics. It's about the raw qualifications you need so that when you show up and you're confirmed for a lifetime judgeship, you actually know what you're doing. And that's really is that basic level of vetting that the Trump administration and now the United States Senate is just, or the Republicans in the Senate, I should say, are just disregarding as if it's nothing. And I think that's really concerning when you think about the quality of the judges and sort of just the baseline competence that you really, these are supposed to be positions that are the pinnacle of a lawyer's career. And they're just being degraded in such a way because the ABA is not being able to play a role.
You know, in many ways, I think that this is a moment of a constitutional crisis. You know, we have one core branch of government, the judiciary, and a president who has little respect for the value, importance, significance, and weight of federal judgeships. The American Bar Association, as Chris notes, is an organization that virtually all lawyers belong to, people on the left, people on the right. It is a nonpartisan slash bipartisan organization. And most of the nominees that they have evaluated throughout the years during the tenures of both Democratic and Republican administrations have met their threshold of it being deemed at least qualified. But already we've seen in year one, two nominees who did not meet that standard. The number is indeed higher, but let me just highlight two. Charles Goodwin, who the ABA concluded was not qualified because of his work habits. And another nominee, Holly Teeter, nominated for a seat in Kansas, who was deemed not qualified because of her utter lack of trial court experience. To me, it is gravely unfortunate and dangerous, this position that we are in. The courts are places where we look to them to resolve controversies and crises, not just in the civil rights area, but we're talking about issues that impact all Americans.
Right. Automobile accidents, wrongful deaths, civil rights. I mean, the range that a district trial court, they hear it all.
And they can set precedents that stand for a very long time. And once you get that judgeship, it is for life, and you can't turn back. You can't reverse a nominee once they're in place. So I think this is a moment of constitutional crisis, and that all Americans should be gravely concerned about the ways in which our president is disrespecting the value of the federal judiciary.
How important is diversity on the bench? I mean, isn't aren't judges, when they're sworn in, to be, they sworn in to just do the right thing and hold to justice and abide by the justice? Why is diversity on the bench important?
Diversity matters. We want a public that can have confidence in the courts. We want courts that reflect the diversity of the communities that they serve. We can't tolerate in 2018 a society in which people who rule from the bench are white men and white men only. But if President Trump had his way, that's probably what he'd like to see. We are in a country that is becoming increasingly diverse. And for the president to not recognize that there are African-Americans, Latinos, women worthy of sitting on our nation's federal courts is deeply, deeply troubling.
Kristen and Chris, give us some examples, if you can, of some key legal decisions or cases that have a direct positive or negative impact on our lives and how those outcomes relate to judicial appointments.
So let's talk about the big victory of the new year. The president issued an executive order last week dismantling the so-called Election Integrity Commission. Some of us call it the Sham Voting Commission.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that again.
So the president comes into office. He believes or pushes this false notion that there are millions of people who voted fraudulently in the 2016 presidential election, suggests that vote fraud is rampant. And so he puts in place this commission that is tasked with going out to look for vote fraud, a problem that we all know doesn't exist. He puts in place commissioners, so-called commissioners. Many of them are people who have long track records of doing work to promote voter suppression across our country. And they go out and hold a hearing up in New Hampshire. All white men come to testify, about a dozen of them. I mean, it's a total sham. And they felt the weight of litigation. Because organizations like mine, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and other organizations immediately filed lawsuits challenging this commission. We argued that they were not operating in a transparent manner, that they were not providing the public a meaningful opportunity to participate. And ultimately, Trump had to issue an order dismantling that commission. And I think that this will be a moment that really stands out when we look back at the Trump era. This is a president who had his hands all over an effort to promote wide-scale voter suppression, because that was the end goal with this commission. At the end of the day, they were probably working towards issuing some kind of report saying, millions of people did vote fraudulently. We need voter ID. We need proof of citizenship. We need to purge the voter registration rolls. So that was an outcome achieved because this administration felt the weight of litigation on them, and we backed them into a wall. We forced them to go into court and stand up before judges and demonstrate that this commission was lawful, and they couldn't. So to me, this is one very powerful example of how the courtroom is really critical in this era of resistance. When this administration takes actions that turns the clock back, takes actions that are unlawful and discriminatory, civil rights lawyers are resorting to the courtroom to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
And I think it really underscores why we have to fight to make sure that we preserve the integrity of our courts and not stand silent as Trump seeks to now stack the courts with all white men who are not qualified and who will bring with them grave hostility to fairly enforcing the law.
I watched recently Marshall, the movie that detailed Thurgood Marshall, some detail to Thurgood Marshall's life. And I even as an attorney, I left the movie thinking, am I doing enough as a lawyer. He was a man who dedicated his life, eventually ended up on the Supreme Court, but dedicated his life, like Kristen and Chris, to being a civil rights attorney. Talk to us a little bit about the civil rights attorneys. I think it's going to make people feel somewhat hopeful that there are people like you who are fighting these fights when they come up, because you don't do it for the glamour and the glitz. Most of our civil rights attorneys don't end up on the Supreme Court. Why do you do it? And tell us, what does that community look like?
Well, one, Thurgood Marshall is someone most appropriate to lift up when we talk about the legacy of civil rights work in our country. Thurgood Marshall is somebody who truly helped to make our democracy a better place by his work on Brown versus Board of Education and so many seminal civil rights cases from the civil rights movement. Isn't it a shame that we have to go back to decades prior to think about a civil rights lawyer like Marshall making their way onto the Supreme Court? Isn't it a shame to think about what's happening today, where you have people who don't by any stretch measure up to the caliber and quality of a Thurgood Marshall now being put forth for federal district and circuit court vacancies? I think right now what we're seeing is that civil rights lawyers really are playing an important role in safeguarding our democracy, because this is an administration that has made clear during every day of year one of its administration that it is hostile to civil rights. They are obstructing and reversing work happening inside the Justice Department, at the U.S. Department of Education, at HUD. Mm-hmm. And civil rights lawyers are the ones who are stepping in to fill in the gap. They are stepping in to protect victims of discrimination across the country. He used to feel like they could find some recourse in the federal government. We are the ones now stepping up to protect them. We're the ones who are resisting and fighting back. And when they do something unlawful, saying, we'll see you in court tomorrow, and filing cases that are putting their back against a wall. And we are the ones who are talking progressively and affirmatively about how we can make our country a better place. And we're talking about opening up and expanding access to democracy and not promoting voter suppression. So the work of civil rights lawyers, I think, is really key.
Because this happens at all levels, as Kristen said, in the administration, in the bureaucracy, in the courts. I mean, civil rights lawyers are fighting these battles every day in many different places.
Absolutely. And I think that the challenge is that where we see inspiration from the civil rights lawyers and the civil rights lawyering community, the Trump administration and Republicans see a threat. And they should, because we're winning case after case after case. But now what are they going to do? They're going to change the rules in the middle of the game.
Yeah.
They're
going to
seek.
And the referees.
They're going to see, exactly.
Yeah.
They're going to seek to put in a judge who's going to overrule what we think is the rule of law, what the civil rights position is. And that really, to me, the success on the Sham Voting Commission is one example. But there's so many, dozens, probably hundreds of lawsuits being filed across the country to stop President Trump from rolling back protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and in particular students, those who want to enroll in the military. He's rolling back clean air and clean water regulations. He's trying to roll back protections in public housing. In every aspect of life, he is seeking to go beyond what the Constitution contemplates, beyond what the law allows. And the only people there to stop him are going to be lawyers and fair-minded judges. And I think that is really what's behind this huge rush to rubber stamp his judges at a record pace, because he knows he's losing. And he knows that if this is a fair fight with the fair judge, he's going to keep losing. And that's really part of what's behind this whole effort that I think we need to really wake up to and make sure that we slow this down and make sure that there really is a thorough review and, where possible, actually rejecting some of these really extreme nominees.
So let's talk about action. Let's talk about how we're called to action. You and your organizations are identifying this problem. You're speaking, shouting from the rafters, this is happening. What can organizations like the National Urban League and the other civil rights organizations, what should we be doing to elevate this issue and to take some action to stop this from happening?
Well, let's talk about what people can do from the ground up. It's really important that people beat the drum and call their senator to express their opposition. Those calls matter. They actually keep a tally on the volume of calls that come in on particular issues. So we need people to really speak up and speak up loudly in opposition to the unqualified, radical people who fall far outside the legal mainstream who this president is advancing to serve on courts. We need to speak up about the lack of racial diversity. How dare we live in an era in 2018 where we have a president who would advance the names of virtually all white men to serve on our federal courts. These are public positions funded off the backs of taxpayers. And so taxpayers, the people, need to speak up and express their opposition and do so loudly. And we need to make sure that we're also integrating this into how we talk about the moment that we're in. I think that judges and courts, it's, you know, it's not the sexiest issue. People aren't talking about this every day, but it really does matter because the cases that are handled by these courts impact every aspect of our lives, from criminal justice to voting rights to employment and fair housing, from health care and right. immigrants' rights. The courts touch issues that shape our lives. And so we need to make sure that we're helping the broader public understand that.
Instead of us paying as much attention to the tweets, we should be paying attention to what's going on with these courts.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Chris, you worked in the White House. And Kristen did a great job of talking about at the grassroots level what we can do. But you know, at the Urban League, the civil rights organizations, don't we have some responsibility to do something about this? I mean, what pressure or what should we be doing?
Absolutely. And I think that what we've seen over the last year is a great awakening of this democratic voice, this small D democratic voice.
Right.
And it matters, right? It matters when you call your senator and say, stop these judges. Or even if you just say, judges are important to me. Right. I think part of the challenge that we have is that we focus a lot on laws, we focus a lot on specific policies, but then we don't actually mention judges in that context. Right, so we talk a lot about, for example, the dreamers, the deferred action childhood arrivals, the kids who sort of come here from a young age and their parents are not in legal status. They come here and their status is at risk now because President Trump is trying to roll back that program. Just yesterday, a federal judge said, whoa, you can't roll back this program. And he put a stop to that. Now, it's a temporary stop, but that's why judges matter. So everybody who's rallying around and caring about these incredibly important immigrants needs to also understand that the courts are important.
Right.
There's not a single issue that you care about that doesn't have a direct connection to the courts, whether it's civil rights, voting rights, labor rights, environment, reproductive justice, LGBT, whatever it is, you have to see the connection to the courts, and then you have to make sure that your senator understands that you see that connection. So that when Thomas Farr comes up for a vote, and he'll probably come up for a vote in a month or so, your senator understands, I don't just want you to vote no. I want you to talk about why this is important and why voting is important and why somebody with this record should never see the light of day inside a courtroom, more or less as a judge. And it's about how do you get your senators to understand that you care about this issue and that not only do you want them to vote the right way, but you want to take them to go the next step and show just how much they care, just how much they understand the impact of these judges on your life.
I want to spend a little time now moving away from the judges, and I want to talk about the Department of Justice, DOJ. I want to talk a little bit about where we are right now with our Department of Justice. And before we get to even some of the key vacancies at the department here in Washington, let's talk about some of the vacancies in the districts. Every judicial district we talked about, they've got judges, but they also have a U.S. attorney who serves locally on those districts. And that U.S. attorney is the federal government's agent at that level. What have you seen in the nomination of U.S. attorneys in this administration?
Also a lack of diversity. The same problem, a lack of racial diversity and a lack of gender diversity. It's a crisis level that we have seen with this administration. And as an African-American woman who sees the diversity of talent that exists across our country, I find this deeply troubling. This is an administration that really is bent on turning the clock back to the Jim Crow era. And I think that when we talk about what's happening with the courts and the whitening of the courts, that we have to recognize that this is really happening across the board.
Mm-hmm.
We got a Ben Carson in virtually every leadership position that we have seen, every major nomination that we have seen from this administration. There are two things. One, a lack of diversity and grave hostility on civil rights.
And I think it's important to note this is not an anti-Republican show because, as you said, Chris, we didn't see those that insensitivity during the Bush administration, either of the Bush administrations. George W. Bush had a more diverse cabinet than this guy does. His appointments were more diverse than this guy's appointments. His father, George Bush Sr., his appointments were more diverse. His cabinet was more diverse. This is something different. This it smells or looks like something different. But U.S. attorneys, are you noticing any pattern? Did Kristen just nail it on the head that it seems to be very much like the judicial nominations?
It is, and I think one of the real challenges when we think about, like, these are the chief law enforcement, federal law enforcement officers in these districts, is it's a result of just how rash President Trump was in firing all of President Obama's U.S. attorneys at once without having any plan in place to replace any of them.
Right. That's important. I want you to repeat that. So President Obama had his U.S. attorneys in the various districts in place, and then they all got a letter one day, right? Or they got a phone call.
Yeah, they all got a letter, a phone call that said, you know what, thank you for your service.
You're gone.
Out. And look, to be fair, that is President Trump's prerogative.
Sure.
That sure isn't the way President Obama did it.
Right.
It was a lot more systematic. It was consulting with home state senators. It was lining up somebody in to replace them and working out the timing in a way that allows for transition, that sort of respects the office, and sort of has a plan for how you're gonna approach law enforcement. Instead, President Trump fires everybody on one day. He puts them in piecemeal. And I think the other thing that's really potentially troubling is the fact that President Obama did not interview any of his U.S. attorneys. There is sort of, as we think about the lines between the Department of Justice and the White House that are being blurred on an almost daily basis today, the Department of Justice isn't actually, it works for the president and yet is independent, right? It's a law enforcement agency that's especially true for U.S. attorneys. President Obama never interviewed any U.S. attorneys, and he could have, but he didn't because he understood and respected those laws, those lines. President Trump has. But he hasn't interviewed all of them. He's only interviewed the ones that he's looking to put forward that he put forward for Washington, D.C., for the Southern District of New York, and for the Southern District of Florida, places where, coincidentally, there may be cases that come up that implicate him. So what does that mean? Even if there's nothing actually technically wrong, this is about justice, and this is about the appearance of justice, and how is he leaning on these potential candidates when he interviews them before he gives them a nomination for these positions? It's really unsettling when you think about all of these subtle, below-the-radar ways that he's seeking to undermine the rule of law and seeking to undermine justice, in addition to sort of all of the big-picture things that we see in the news every day.
And in past administrations, Kristen, we've relied, especially in the civil rights community, on the Department of Justice to be our partner, our friend, to help us root out discrimination. Talk to our listeners a little bit about what's going on here at the big DOJ with Attorney General Sessions. Who's being nominated? Who's been mentioned for the Civil Rights Division? What's going on with that office? Are we going to be able to have that partnership at the civil rights community that we enjoyed during the Obama administration with Vanita Gupta?
So it's important to recognize that the U.S. Department of Justice is the most important federal law enforcement agency in the country, the most important law enforcement agency in the country. And they kind of set the tone and tenor for how prosecutors do their work across the country. So what happens inside the halls of justice really matters. And what we have seen under Attorney General Jeff Sessions is work happening at a rapid pace to undo all of the good work that has happened over the last several years. We've seen reversals on federal guidance on issues like, you know, the government was phasing out use of private prisons for federal inmates.
Right. That's important. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
President Obama was phasing out the use of private for-profit prisons.
Right. That were sites of abuse. All of the data showed that privately run prisons were not safe environments, not for the inmates, not for the people who work there, that the profit motive driving how private
makes
prisons
sense. It made sense to Republicans and Democrats. This is not a good thing.
Right.
Let's
bipartisan opposition. Jeff Sessions comes in and reverses course, scraps the guidance and basically says, we're going to continue using private prisons. Right then you think, well, he must have some ideas about how to keep those prisons filled. And sure enough, he issues this new directive to prosecutors across the country saying, ramp up your sentencing. We want you to impose the harshest sentence, pursue the harshest charges possible for low-level nonviolent offenses, right? So he is reigniting the war on drugs.
Right.
We've seen him reverse positions in long-standing civil rights cases. So the Texas voter ID battle that has been brewing for the last 3.5+ years, all of the data, even data that the Justice Department itself put forth in the case during the life of the case, showed that Texas's voter ID law was strict and restrictive. It had a discriminatory impact on Black and Latino voters. Sessions comes in and says, you know what, we're no longer arguing that that law has a discriminatory purpose. So at every turn, we're seeing Sessions take action. He eliminated guidance on transgender students and on LGBT issues. His approach to governing at DOJ has been, let's just obstruct and reverse. Let's right. just turn the clock back.
Pull back and not push forward.
Yeah. What's so troubling is this is actually the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Division. And this has been an agency that has been on the front lines of a lot of progress that we've seen in the country. This is an agency that is charged primarily with enforcement under the Voting Rights Act and a lot of our critical federal civil rights laws. And to see what's happening inside DOJ now is deeply troubling. Eric Dryband is the name that has been put forth as someone to run the Civil Rights Division. He made it out of Senate Judiciary. He has not come up for a full Senate floor vote, but I think that that is something we need to keep an eye on. These are dark and treacherous times, and it's made the work of civil rights lawyers more difficult because basically we are the ones stepping up to be the people's justice. Right. We are the ones who are stepping in to fill in the gaps and to do, you know, stepping up to do the work that Sessions is no longer committed to doing at DOJ.
Right. Chris.
Yeah. And I think that, as Kristen said, the tone is set from the top down. And so you see, I already saw there's a one of the accomplishments of some of the U.S. attorneys under the Obama administration was setting up civil rights units within their U.S. attorney's offices across the country. And already one U.S. attorney has replaced that unit with the violent crime unit. So no more civil rights unit. Now we have a violent crime unit. I think we all know what that means, right? It's right. not even pretending that they're going to do anything other than resurrect this war on drugs and sort of go after low-level offenders with the highest possible sentence just so that they can fill these prisons. And I think that this is something that we have to be very, very cautious and very aware of sort of at every level, because this is really going to have a day-to-day impact on the way that these cases are prosecuted.
And let me give one recent, fresh example of something else dangerous that Sessions has done. There's an issue that more and more people are focusing on, and that's the way in which our justice system punishes poor people, entraps them in the justice system merely because of their inability to pay fines and fees tied to low-level offenses like traffic violations or nonviolent offenses. And people get bogged down with these fines and fees simply because they can't pay their way out.
Right.
And the Justice Department did some great work on this issue during the Obama administration and importantly issued some guidance, federal guidance, that many courts and people in the justice system were sitting up and paying attention to and saying, OK, we want to make sure that we're complying with the Constitution, because this practice actually is unconstitutional and violates a Supreme Court case called Bearden versus Georgia. And there was great guidance that was helping to promote reform. And Sessions, at the end of December, said, I'm pulling back the guidance. Vicious hostility at every turn to work to promote civil rights, work to promote compliance with the Constitution is all that we have seen from this attorney general. And it's quite shameful.
Last topic I want to talk about is something that's very timely, and it's a hot issue all over the country. There are many states and jurisdictions that have decriminalized or legalized marijuana. And this administration has come forward, and I want you to talk to our listeners a little bit about that. There are people who are thinking, well, my state has legalized this or decriminalized this use of my recreational use, but it's still illegal under federal law. This attorney general seems, and this president seems to be saying, we don't care if your jurisdiction or your state legalized it or decriminalized it. We reserve the right to prosecute men and women who do. And so does that go to what you were saying about that they seem to be ramping up this war on drugs, even if in that state has said, no, we're not calling this an illegal narcotic anymore or a drug, an improper use of a drug. Are you? What are you seeing in that? Because I don't know that average Americans get the, if it's legal, it's legal, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting area where public attitudes have shifted dramatically over the last decade. There's now overwhelming public support for not criminalizing marijuana use. And we've seen many states that are moving in that direction. We're hearing from patients who are talking about the medicinal benefits of using marijuana. There is a young girl who has filed suit against the Justice Department for taking action that will impair and make it more difficult for her to access medicinal marijuana. But again, our Attorney General has exhibited grave hostility. And it's taking action that just stands fully contrary to the overwhelming view of Americans that this is just not a place worth focusing our limited criminal justice resources. So, again, Jeff Sessions is, you know, taking action that's turning the clock back.
Right.
And I think the other interesting thing about this, and we'll see if this debate ends up being a turning point, is Senator Cory Gardner, Republican from Colorado,
right,
said that before I voted to confirm Jeff Sessions, he promised me he would not change this guidance.
This guidance.
And he has now.
Right.
And now, as a result, Cory Gardner said, I'm going to block every single appointment to the Department of Justice, including Eric Dryban for the Civil Rights Division,
right,
including a couple others. Will this be the turning point where some reasonable Republicans say, whoa, enough is enough. You've turned the clock back too much. You've lied to me. Like, what is the line at which a Republican is going to stand up and say enough? And actually, not just in words, not just in tweets, but in actual actions, stand up to this president, stand up to this attorney general, and do something about it. And I think this could be part of the tipping point we see where people say, that's it. You lied to me. This is so contrary to what the views of my constituency is and where the views of the country are, and I'm not going to let you get away with it anymore.
Well, it will be interesting to see, and we will be paying attention. What I've gotten from this episode is people need to be paying attention to the judges. We need to be paying attention to our legal system, our U.S. attorneys, our attorney generals. We need to be paying more attention to that and maybe focusing a little bit less time on tweets and just inflammatory side issues.
And the public has a role to play at this moment. It's so important to speak up, to express opposition, to call senators, to call your local representative and register your voice of opposition. But most importantly, it's important that we vote.
Yes.
And this is a midterm election year. I kind of hate that term because every election matters.
Right.
Whether we're talking about local, state, or federal elections, the stakes are high. Who's sitting at the table going to bat for you matters. And so the one most important takeaway, I think, is that there is great power in our votes. And I hope that people will vote in each and every election that arises in their community and hold their elected officials accountable.
Yes. Kristen, I hope our listeners, even though we talked about a very serious issue and a concerning issue, I hope they can at least rest assured that we've got people like you and Chris who are at the helm every day fighting to stop this rollback from happening. So I want to thank you so much for being here. If people want to learn more about the Lawyers Committee, more about you and the work that you're doing, how can they get in touch with you?
To learn more about the work of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, you can visit www.lawyerscommittee.org. And you can follow me on Twitter, Kristen Clark, J-D, KristenClarkJD.
Follow Kristen. I do. And I'm always able to learn so much about what's going on. And Chris, we want to be in touch with you or know about where you stand on some of those issues. How do we get in touch with you?
You can follow me on Twitter.
Okay.
I'm not quite as prolific as Kristen, CDKANG76. And I'm also working with a lot of, there are some fantastic organizations sort of around the country and around the table. I think one of them to lift up is the Leadership Conference for Civil and Human Rights.
Absolutely.
Civilrights.org. They're doing some tremendous work around judicial nominations. They're another organization to follow and really see how we're going to take this fight to them.
Absolutely. Well, look, thank you both very much for being here today and being part of one of our first podcast editions. We wanted you to be part of our first because this issue is very important, and we thought we could do our part to highlight it. So thank you both very much and continue the great work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the great work of the National Urban League.
Thank you. Each week, we highlight one of our Urban League affiliates for their work to advance our movement. As you know, the National Urban League is a historic civil rights organization with 90 affiliates working all across this country in 36 states and the District of Columbia. This week, we are recognizing the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga, who recently completed an inaugural program that provided training for minorities to better prepare them for top leadership positions and to promote inclusion in the business community. Urban League leaders developed the program after trying to bring more people onto its board and seeing an obvious lack of people of color and women in executive ranks. The fellows participated in an executive leadership sessions. They did community engagement activities and worked with local executives over a 10-month period. After the program, the fellows continued to work with mentors to further their skills. The Urban League of Greater Chattanooga has plans to test the program for 3 years and then to evaluate the results. Congratulations to the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. For more information on this program, visit www.ulchatt.net. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to listen and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.